The Likeness by Tana French is not your average crime thriller. It's a psychological labyrinth that has captivated readers since its 2008 publication, earning a devoted following that includes celebrities like Sarah Jessica Parker and Gillian Flynn. The novel's premise, a detective impersonating a murder victim who looks exactly like her, sounds implausible on paper, yet French's hypnotic prose makes you believe every moment. This second installment in her Dublin Murder Squad series has been praised for its atmospheric writing and complex character study, with The Washington Post calling it one of the most psychologically sophisticated mysteries of the decade. What makes this book truly remarkable is how it transforms a police procedural into a meditation on identity, belonging, and the dangerous allure of reinvention.
Some nights, Detective Cassie Maddox still dreams of Whitethorn House. In her dreams, she climbs worn stone steps and enters empty, sun-filled rooms that smell of hyacinths and beeswax polish. The house appears abandoned, bedrooms bare except for dust-draped furniture, piano lid raised as if someone just stepped away, dining table set for five with place settings untouched for months. Yet, she hears faint sounds, whispers behind closed doors, scuffles in the attic, a stifled giggle echoing down the corridor. Chasing these noises through winding hallways and shadowed rooms, she catches a flash of movement in an old gilt-framed mirror, her own face laughing back at her with an expression she doesn't recognize. This haunting prologue sets the stage for a story where identity becomes fluid and dangerous, where the boundaries between self and other blur into uncertainty. 4 years after working undercover as Lexi Madison, Cassie has transferred to domestic violence, seeking refuge from the psychological toll of her previous case. The move to a desk job was meant to provide stability, a return to normalcy after months of living someone else's life. But when Detective Sam O'Neill calls her to a crime scene in a derelict cottage near Glenski Village, she discovers something impossible. A murder victim who not only looks exactly like her, but carries ID identifying her as Alexandra Madison, the very undercover identity Cassie and her former boss Frank Mackey had meticulously crafted years ago. The victim lies peacefully arranged on ancient floorboards, positioned as if sleeping, with a single, precise stab wound to the chest. Cassie is stunned by the perfect resemblance. Same heart-shaped face, same green eyes, same delicate features, even the same small scar on her upper lip from a childhood accident. Someone has somehow discovered the fictional identity she and Frank created, breathed life into it, and inhabited it so completely that even her fingerprints show no match in any database. Now, that person lies dead, wearing Cassie's face like a mask. What follows is Frank's outrageous yet compelling proposal. Since the victim's death isn't public knowledge yet, Cassie could step into her life, assume her identity once again, but this time as a dead woman's doppelganger. Despite Sam's passionate objections about the psychological and physical dangers, Cassie finds herself irresistibly drawn to this bizarre opportunity. It's partly the adrenaline rush of undercover work calling to her again, the thrill of becoming someone else, but there's something more. An almost obsessive need to understand this woman who stole her carefully constructed alias and made it her own. As Cassie prepares to step into a dead woman's life, she doesn't realize that this investigation will force her to question not just the victim's identity, but her own sense of self.
Whitethorn House stands at the end of a cherry tree-lined avenue, a perfectly proportioned Georgian beauty nestled between mountains and rolling hills. Inside live four Trinity College postgraduate English students who have formed an unusually tight-knit group: Daniel March, the wealthy, reserved heir who owns the house; Justin Mannering, the fastidious son of a Belfast lawyer; Raphael Rafe, the artistic, moody trust fund kid; and Abby Stone, who rose from foster care through hard work and determination. When Cassie arrives at Whitethorn House posing as Lexi, she's struck by an uncanny sense of familiarity beyond her research. The smell of old wood and lavender, the light on the floorboards, the echoing footsteps. The housemates welcome her warmly, with Abby hugging her and whispering, "Welcome home."
Their closeness is immediately apparent. They move and speak with seamless coordination, finishing each other's thoughts and anticipating each other's needs. The household operates with surprising formality, structured mealtimes, designated sitting spots, and traditional activities like reading aloud and playing piano. They don't own a TV or computers, preferring manual typewriters and books. While Frank mocks their technology-free existence, Cassie finds herself enchanted by their unhurried lifestyle. Something slow, something soft, something with wide spaces and its own sure-footed swaying rhythms. As she settles into Lexi's life, Cassie notices the unusual physical intimacy between the housemates, constant casual touching, shared belongings, and blurred boundaries. They take sips from each other's glasses, wear each other's clothes, and share everything except underwear. During a tipsy evening making daisy chains on the lawn, Cassie realizes what this arrangement reminds her of. Not a real-life family, but one from children's books. Daniel as the distant but affectionate father, Justin and Abby alternating as protective mother figures, Rafe as the moody teenager, and Lexi as the spoiled little sister. She recognizes that none of them likely had normal family experiences. Daniel orphaned, Abby in foster care, Justin and Rafe exiled from their homes. They had collected fragments of what they imagined family life to be and constructed their own version, building the family none of them ever had. As Cassie delves deeper into Lexi's life, a fascinatingly complex picture emerges of a woman who elevated identity transformation into an art form. Frank's FBI contact initially reveals that Lexi had been operating under the identity of May Ruth Thibodeau, supposedly born in North Carolina in 1975. This identity trail led to a dramatic twist when they discovered May Ruth had vanished in 2000 after stealing her fiancé Chad's car and several thousand dollars from his bank account. However, the investigation peeled back yet another layer of deception. The real May Ruth Thibodeau had died of meningitis at age 4. Lexi had masterfully appropriated a dead child's identity, a common technique among professional identity thieves, but executed with remarkable precision. This revelation electrifies Cassie, who finds herself grudgingly admiring the sheer audacity and competence of Lexi's self-reinvention. Frank, however, sees a darker pattern, the desperate movements of someone being hunted, forced to shed identities like snake skins until her pursuers finally caught up with her at Whitethorn House. Their investigation uncovers a trail of previous incarnations spanning three continents. In New Zealand, she was Naomi Ballantyne, an exceptionally efficient temp worker known for her organizational skills. In San Francisco, she transformed herself into Alana Goldman, a free-spirited hippie who taught yoga. In Liverpool, she became Mags McKenzie, an up-and-coming hat designer with a growing clientele. Each identity was meticulously crafted and maintained, complete with appropriate accents, mannerisms, and backstories. The truth finally emerges about her original identity, Grace Corrigan, who first fled her home at 16, following her mother's death during childbirth. This traumatic event appeared to trigger her lifetime of perpetual motion and reinvention. What sets Lexi apart is her extraordinary ability to alter not just surface details, but her entire personality to perfectly suit her environment, a skill that goes far beyond typical identity theft. While Cassie struggled through her 8 months undercover, constantly aware of maintaining her facade, Lexi had seamlessly woven herself into the fabric of the Whitethorn House group. She became exactly what they needed, simultaneously bubbly and mischievous with her housemates while maintaining an appropriate academic distance with outsiders. Frank, drawing on decades of law enforcement experience, notes that this level of complete personality transformation challenges even the most skilled undercover operatives. The case takes an even more complicated turn with the discovery that Lexi was pregnant when she died. Cassie, examining Lexi's datebook with detective's precision, uncovers a pattern of circled dates, approximately 27 days apart, that abruptly stop in late March, suggesting the moment Lexi discovered her pregnancy. This revelation adds another layer of complexity to the investigation. Not only must they consider who might have wanted Lexi dead, but whether the father of her unborn child played a role in her murder.
The pregnancy also raises questions about whether Lexi's plans to disappear again were interrupted, or if this development had caused her to finally consider putting down roots.
While the housemates initially seem like the obvious suspects, Cassie discovers another potential motive, the intense hostility between Whitethorn House and Glenskahi Yelich. The villagers despise the big house residents, viewing them as interlopers and reminders of historical oppression. Sam uncovers 4 burglaries over 3 years. Nothing stolen, just vandalism like slashed curtains, smashed crockery, and urine on furniture. The house was regularly vandalized with bricks for windows, dead rats in the letterbox, and disturbing graffiti reading, "West Brits out, kill the landlords," and most ominously, "Baby killers out." This hostility stems from a tragic historical incident. In 1915, Daniel's great-uncle William March returned from WW1 with shell shock and began spending time with villagers, breaking his engagement to a woman of his own class. A local girl became pregnant, naming William as the father. Ostracized by the community, she hanged herself. William subsequently had a breakdown and was institutionalized, while his brother Simon, who left Whitethorn House to Daniel, framed the tragedy as a moral lesson against lust and mixing outside one's natural level in society. The timing of Lexi's murder, between 11:30 p.m. and 1 a.m., pub closing time, matches the pattern of previous vandalism incidents. When a rock crashes through the window with a note reading, "We will burn you out," Cassie, Daniel, and Rafe chase the culprit down the lane, resulting in a violent confrontation. The suspect, John Naylor, is brought in for questioning but denies involvement in the murder despite admitting to the vandalism. Naylor reveals another layer to the village's resentment. Years ago, a property developer wanted to buy Whitethorn House to build a luxury hotel with a golf course, which would have revitalized Glenskahi with jobs. But the Marches refused to sell, essentially condemning the village to slow economic death. This developer, Edward Ned Hanrahan, becomes another suspect when Cassie discovers he had been secretly meeting with Lexi. Following Frank's astute advice to look for the cracks in the housemates' seemingly perfect friendship, Cassie begins noticing subtle tensions beneath their harmonious surface. She observes how conversations shift when certain topics arise, how glances are exchanged, and how carefully constructed their responses become. 2 significant boundaries emerge. Their pasts are strictly off-limits, enforced by Daniel's firm no-pasts rule, and they demonstrate remarkable skill at redirecting conversations whenever she ventures into personal history, a defensive mechanism that seems almost choreographed in its precision. The facade begins to crumble when Cassie discovers a weathered cigarette tin tucked away in an unlikely spot. Inside, she finds a carefully folded note from Ned to Lexi, cryptically expressing interest in that matter we were talking about. The discovery leads her to arrange a clandestine meeting with Ned, who reveals a shocking truth. He'd been secretly negotiating to buy Lexi's share of Whitethorn House for 200,000 euros, a substantial sum that would have given her complete financial independence. This revelation represents the ultimate betrayal of trust within their carefully constructed family. Years earlier, Daniel had made an extraordinary gesture by transferring ownership of Whitethorn House to all 5 of them just months after inheriting it. This wasn't merely a financial decision. It was a profound statement of trust, commitment, and belief in their shared future. By attempting to sell her share behind their backs, Lexi was effectively dismantling the very foundation of their collective dream. The timing of Lexi's planned betrayal coincides poignantly with her discovery of pregnancy. This wasn't just another of her impulsive attempts to run away. This was a carefully calculated exit strategy. She needed both the money and the clean break to start a new life with her unborn child, far from the complications of her current existence. As Cassie explains to Frank with newfound clarity, she wasn't just running. She'd found her exit and she was taking it. This revelation casts new light on the housemates' strange behavior since Cassie's arrival. Their perfect world had already been shattered the night Lexi died, when Abby accidentally discovered Ned's note in a shared jacket pocket. The timing suggests a confrontation may have occurred that very night, adding another layer of complexity to Lexi's death.
the discovery had fractured their carefully maintained illusion of perfect harmony, revealing the vulnerability of their chosen family to individual desires and secrets. The breach of trust was so fundamental that it threatened not just their living arrangement, but their entire collective identity built on absolute loyalty and transparency. After weeks of carefully gaining the housemaid's trust, Cassie finally uncovers the horrifying truth about the night Lexi died. The catalyst was Ned's damning note, discovered by Abby in the pocket of Lexi's jacket, a discovery that would shatter their carefully constructed world. When Lexi desperately lunged for the note, Daniel restrained her with unexpected force, while Rafe, his voice trembling with anger, read its contents aloud to the group. The scene devolved into chaos, furniture knocked aside, glasses shattering, Lexi's fists connecting with Rafe's face as she fought like a cornered animal. The air was thick with screaming accusations and long-buried resentments. In the violent maelstrom that followed, someone grabbed a kitchen knife. To this day, none of them claims to know who actually wielded it. The blade flashed in the dim light, and suddenly Lexi was stumbling backward, her white shirt blooming red. The back door slammed with such force it rattled the windows, leaving behind an awful silence broken only by ragged breathing and the soft pat of blood dripping onto the kitchen floor. Daniel immediately took control of the situation with an almost mechanical precision that suggested this wasn't his first crisis. He dispatched Abby and Rafe to maintain the house's appearance, while he and Justin ventured into the maze of dark lanes surrounding Whitethorn House. They found Lexi collapsed in the abandoned cottage, her skin already growing cold in the night air. Daniel checked her pulse and pronounced her dead, a crucial mistake, as she was actually in a deep coma that would ultimately save her life. What followed was a masterclass in criminal cover-up, orchestrated by Daniel with disturbing attention to detail. He sent Justin back to gather Lexi's personal effects, her house keys with a distinctive purple keychain, the silver wallet she always carried, and her reliable torch, all staged to suggest she'd simply gone for her customary evening walk. They meticulously repositioned her body in the cottage's only dry room, methodically erased all traces of their presence, and swept away their footprints in the dirt with tree branches. Back at the house, Daniel's efficiency took on an almost theatrical quality. He ordered everyone to strip, bundling their blood-stained clothes with ordinary laundry in a calculated mix of colors and fabrics that would mask any evidence. Most chilling was his insistence on creating their alibi in real time, turning back every clock in the house and forcing them to replay their regular poker night. He even dealt Lexi's hands, mimicking her characteristic betting patterns and favorite phrases, building a fiction so detailed it was almost convincing enough to make them forget the truth themselves. This elaborate performance created their perfect alibi, a normal evening of cards with Lexi losing first, as she often did, and heading out for her routine walk at precisely 11:30 p.m. The others continued playing, went to bed after midnight, and discovered her absence the next morning, a carefully crafted narrative that would hold up under initial police scrutiny, but would ultimately begin to unravel under Cassie's determined investigation. As Cassie's precarious time undercover reaches its breaking point, Daniel confronts her in the garden at dusk, his keen perception having finally pierced through her carefully constructed facade as Lexi. The tension crackles between them as he reveals he's known for days that she isn't really their long-dead friend. They negotiate an unusual compromise. He won't expose her identity if she grants him time to shield his chosen family from what's coming. This delicate arrangement shatters when Frank, sensing breakthrough in the case, summons all five residents to Dublin Castle for intensive questioning. The interrogation leaves everyone raw and defensive. Upon returning to Whitethorn House, where autumn wind rattles the windows and darkness gathers early, Cassie decides to force the truth into the open. In the familiar drawing room where they've shared countless evenings, she produces the damning evidence, the note discovered in Lexi's jacket pocket. The housemates, cornered at last, begin to unravel their carefully woven story, sharing details about that fatal night, though they dance around the crucial question of who wielded the knife. Daniel's arrival shifts the dynamic dramatically. Rafe, his composure finally breaking, hurls a devastating accusation across the room that Daniel had deliberately left Lexi to bleed out in the cottage, knowing that prompt medical attention might have saved her life. The weight of this charge hangs heavy in the air until Cassie shatters it with her own truth. "I was pregnant. I was going to have a baby. It died." The words echo in the sudden silence, landing like physical blows. The revelation triggers chaos. Rafe, processing that the lost child was his, transforms his grief into rage directed at Justin. As he launches himself across the room, two weapons appear simultaneously. Daniel wielding Uncle Simon's antique Webley revolver from the war, while Cassie draws her police-issued firearm, finally exposing her true identity as Detective Maddox. Police sirens wail in the distance, growing closer. Daniel, perhaps seeing the inevitable end approaching, offers a detailed confession about stabbing Lexi, crafting an intricate narrative that absolves the others of direct involvement. In what Frank later clinically describes as suicide by cop, Daniel raises his weapon, leaving Cassie no choice but to fire. The bullet strikes his chest, and as he falls, his expression transforms not into one of agony or terror, but into an unsettling serenity, as if this was always how it had to end. The aftermath unfolds like a Greek tragedy's final act. John Naylor, the groundskeeper who'd long resented the house and its inhabitants, sets Whitethorn ablaze, reducing decades of history to ash. The surviving housemates face brief detention for conspiracy to murder, though prosecutors can't make the charges stick. Their tight-knit group dissolves. Rafe accepts a prestigious London banking position arranged through his father's connections. Justin retreats to teach at a remote northern boys' school. And Abby, perhaps the most affected, moves to a modest Ranelagh flat where she struggles alone with both her unfinished PhD and the weight of everything that happened. The likeness is ultimately about identity, how we construct ourselves and how easily those constructions can unravel. Cassie, who lost her parents at 5 and grew up without siblings or blood connections, finds herself drawn to Whitethorn House and its makeshift family. She begins to lose herself in Lexi's life, just as Lexi herself had repeatedly reinvented her identity to fit her surroundings. The house itself becomes a character, a beautiful, decaying Georgian mansion that represents both sanctuary and prison. Its isolation allows the 5 friends to create their own perfect world away from society's demands, but this isolation also enables their codependence and inability to face reality. When Lexi's pregnancy threatens this arrangement, introducing an outsider who would change their dynamics forever, the fragile equilibrium shatters. In the end, Cassie chooses a different path than Lexi. Rather than running from commitment, she accepts Sam's marriage proposal, knowing it means delaying or sacrificing her return to Murder Squad. Yet she keeps the tape of her final conversation with the housemates rather than destroying it, preserving that connection for some future day. The novel closes with Cassie's reflection that she hoped to dream of Lexi, but never does. She only dreams of the empty house, with whispers just around corners and someone laughing in the mirror. She hopes that in Lexi's final moments, she experienced all the lives she might have lived, weddings, children, growing old with Daniel, and Abby singing, that in that half hour, she lived all her million lives. Like the best psychological thrillers, The Likeness leaves us questioning the boundaries between self and other, reality and fantasy, truth and deception. As Daniel tells Cassie, "All I ever wanted was here in this house," a sentiment that captures both the beauty and tragedy of their shared delusion, a perfect world that could only exist in isolation, destined to burn when exposed to reality.